Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Wow, have we got an incredible guest for you today. Lieutenant Dan Crenshaw, Republican congressman from Texas. Let me tell you a little bit about this guy. In 2012, on his third tour of duty in Afghanistan, an improvised explosive device left Dan Crenshaw's right eye destroyed and his left eye blinded. Only through a careful application of surgical hands and what doctors called a miracle did he regain partial vision in his left eye. This is why he wears now the signature patch. And yet he persevered, completing two more deployments. Why? Well, he says there are certain stories that we tell ourselves about the hardships that we face. We can become paralyzed by adversity, or we can adapt and overcome. We can be fragile, or we can be able to find fortitude. Crenshaw delivers a set of lessons in his new book that help you do just that. The new book is called Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. Lieutenant Dan Crenshaw, now congressman from Texas, here on the Disruption Zone. Congressman, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've got a new book out, Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. I definitely want to talk about that, and I want to talk about how that plays into what's happening right now in America with what seems to be like everybody joining the stay at home and bury my head in the sand cult. But first of all, let me just get a little bit of background on your service. You were Navy SEAL for 10 years, Bronze Star. You were injured in battle and then went back for two more tours. How was that?
Oh, it was an experience. It's a broad question, but I write about that a lot in the book. We just came out last week, just hit the New York Times bestseller list. And, it's a journey. I wouldn't trade it for anything. The SEALs made me who I am. I never wanted to leave, but I had to, and moved on to a different way to serve.
Yet you, as a congressman, have become both a lightning rod for the left, but also a hero of people who appreciate someone who kind of stands up for what they believes in and doesn't really care that much about trolls. And that's what I think a lot of people love about you, is just the way you handle that. You're used to it. You let it roll off your back, and you kind of give it right back to them in a way.
Yeah, and it turned out to be a great experience for everybody. And I write about the Pete Davidson SNL experience in one of the chapters, and that was kind of the impetus. That entire experience of outrage culture, or bucking outrage culture, was a bit of the impetus for the idea for writing the book. However, the entire experience doesn't really take up any space in the book. It's not really something I talk about a whole lot. I give people the background and the story and an analysis of it.
Right.
And talk about how it could have gone a very different direction. You know, I could have unleashed the outrage mob against SNL, demanded they be canceled, demanded that Davidson get fired. But we didn't do that. And what that allowed was for SNL to actually show the right amount of shame. And I have a whole chapter called The Right Sense of Shame. And it's something we've forgotten how to do in our culture. It's always extremes of either bow down to the outrage mob or don't apologize at all.
Right.
And sometimes it's some in between is good. And that's what we were able to do with the Saturday Night Live experience.
Well, I think what you showed there, for those that don't remember, Pete Davidson, a comedian on Saturday Night Live, made fun of you. And then instead of being upset and angry and, like you said, unleashing an outrage mob, you went on there and you went back and forth with him. And I think what it showed was that Davidson was trying to be funny, and he didn't understand what he was being funny about. And oftentimes when we lose our way, and what causes outrage culture is maybe we just say something that we don't understand exactly why it maybe isn't funny to someone else. And you sort of showed America how to handle that. You know what I mean? You stood up for yourself, but you didn't get mad and whine and cry. You just stood up for yourself, and then you went in there and you corrected the situation, which I think a lot of conversation could use that.
Yeah, exactly. There's, in general, as we debate each other, there's this there's this temptation to try to win the conversation or try to talk at somebody and to refuse to listen to what they're trying to say. You don't have to agree with what they're trying to say, but it's very helpful to listen to it.
Right.
And especially if you're actually trying to win. I mean, if the real goal is winning a political debate, then I would assume that what that means to you is persuading the other person.
Right.
And if you're going to persuade the other person, you do have to listen to them and then explain to them maybe why their set of solutions isn't the right one and how. But usually what I write about in the book a lot is that our political culture has replaced sophisticated argument with sort of this sassy, passionate, you know, owning of the other side.
Right.
And that's fun. I get it, especially on social media, but it's also useless. And we need to do better.
Well, I wonder if, as we kind of segue into what's going on in America right now with the COVID-19 situation, and I feel like, I don't know about you, Congressman Crenshaw, but I kind of feel like the whole country's joined a weird cult. Like 75% of America has joined this weird cult where I'm going to tell on my neighbor because I don't think they're social distancing the right way, or no, we all need to stay in our homes. I saw a terrifying poll that 81% of Americans think we should continue what we're doing right now, although I think that poll was skewed because it wasn't clear what they meant by social distancing. But
exactly,
it scares me that there's so many Americans have just said, you know what, screw freedom, I'm scared, I'm going to stay in my home. And then when you combine that with sort of social media and that owning and that whatever you want to call it, you know, it's like no one can speak out against that paradigm now. You're immediately accused of wanting to kill people.
Right. I wrote about this in The Hill. I wrote an op-ed last week on this about the need to have reasonable conversations in a time like this, because it's so easy for that political opportunism to take place, for that finger pointing to take place, and to say, "Oh, how many lives is that job worth?" Well, that's not the right question, because I could easily say, "Okay, well, you know, I want to save 40,000 lives a year, and I'm not let anybody drive." Mm-hmm. And you're a bad person if you disagree with me because you want to kill 40,000 people. I can say that. But that would be stupid.
Right.
And just like it's stupid now to say that, well, we got to indefinitely lock down until, you know, the curve is at the right place. But they never define what the right place is.
Right.
Because they can't. So leaders are horribly, especially at the local level, because I think that the ability to analyze this difficult situation just isn't there.
Uh-huh.
And they're horribly misinterpreting the data.
Right.
I see it here in Houston where there's this obsession with the peak. Well, what does that mean to you, though? How high is the supposed peak? And can our hospital system deal with that peak? If the answer is yes, and it is yes, by the way, like our hospitals are empty.
Right.
Well, then there's no good reason for you to be extending the guidelines even further. You have to think through the policy. People are not thinking through this,
right,
and they're not messaging it to the public correctly, and so the public's just scared and confused.
Right.
No, we have to talk about how to live with the pandemic alongside opening up our society. And there's going to be risk mitigation and social distancing that occurs within that reopening, of course. It's like you mentioned that poll. I totally agree. I remember that poll. And I was like, well, how was the question asked?
Right.
And it turns out that the question is asked in a very vague way. And that's not the right question.
Right.
You gotta ask a little bit. You got to go deeper.
Well, isn't it the question being asked by the media part of the problem, the way the media is dialing this up? I think the media wants us to be in this permanent lockdown situation because it drives ratings.
It almost seems that way.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. And
I don't know why. I mean, I think they're just so used to being combative.
Right.
And trying to oppose whatever the president says that they sort of place themselves in that position.
Yeah.
I think if the president said, we got to be on lockdown for 6 months, I don't care how many people lose their jobs, I think they would freak out and go the opposite direction.
But
they just do the opposite of what he says. It's like clockwork. So they don't actually have opinions. They don't actually have principles that they rely on. It's just pure opportunism.
Right. But then they turn around and they take a poll like that that's written badly, and they use it to bludgeon anyone who wants to, again, question that status quo. You know.
Yeah, it's this virtue signaling and kind of moral grandstanding that happens, and it's just this isn't the time for it. We can't do that right now. We have to have real discussions and like real debate about how to interpret the data and what to do about it.
So let's dive into that a little bit, because you being a guy who is a combat veteran who looks at this maybe from the sort of military standpoint, and I've actually gotten a lot of interesting tidbits out of my military friends when I call them up and say, how should we attack this? You know, So from that perspective, what is the best way forward? Because I believe that that there's going to have to be a new normal. I think the old normal's gone. I may never shake anybody's hand again, not because I don't want to, but because they may not want to shake my hand, you know? How should we properly attack this? Because the new numbers came out today, 22 million jobless Americans. I had a nurse on Twitter who, speaking of the outrage culture, was like, why don't you put on a mask and go on the front lines? And I'm like, wait a minute. Why don't you switch places with a guy I know who 2 weeks before this all started leveraged everything he had to start a new business and now has nothing, right? You're not the only person that gets to have an opinion here. How do we attack this? Right. Save lives and save businesses.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that is a toxic accusation.
Right.
You know, from that. And it's unfortunate to see that. So the way we think about things as the military is we have a mission, and that mission carries with it risk. And so you mitigate that risk to the greatest extent possible. If I wanted to save the life of every SEAL in my platoon, we just would never leave the wire. We would never leave the base, and we would make excuses as to why we can't go on this mission or that mission. And we could. We could have done that, and everybody would be safe. Mm-hmm. But that's not doing your job. And so what is our mission now? Our mission is to live. Our mission is to live within our some sense of normalcy. The current status is not sustainable. Anybody who claims it is just is whistling past the graveyard or, like you said, didn't lose everything, right? They're probably working from home. They still have a job. And or like that nurse, she has a sense of purpose.
Right.
You know, she does have a job, clearly, and she gets to actually feel good about herself. She's fighting the fight. And right. Great. I love that.
I respect the heck out of what
she's
doing.
I'm very proud of our healthcare workers. But get out of your bubble.
Right.
There are other consequences here. And so, yes, of course we can live in a new normal and risk mitigate, just like we risk mitigate when we drive 80 miles an hour down the highway. We have lanes of traffic. We have rules of the road. We have airbags. There are things we do to mitigate risk, and this is no different. There is a new normal. You can go back to work and change your office setup so that you're not staring at each other right in the face all the time. Don't shake hands. Wear masks. Maybe masks are the new normal. There's lots of things we do differently. I'm not saying that we get right back to rock concerts with tens of thousands of people in one place.
Right.
That'll probably happen later. But there's no reason why our local furniture stores and hardware stores can't be open. Okay.
Yeah.
Like there's, you know, let's have some common sense here and allow people to live with a sense of personal responsibility and duty to each other.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in my book quite a bit. The personal responsibility theme is so important. And there's this weird tendency in our culture these days to completely throw that away and to always be looking for someone else to save us or to blame.
Yeah.
And that is such an unhealthy cultural trend, and it's not how we get out of this. And I talk about a sense of duty in Chapter 7, about the need to live and conduct your smaller missions in life so that you can actually live the bigger mission.
Right.
And this is more important than ever to live that right now.
Your book is called Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. I love the title. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine last night, and we were talking about, you know, kind of an amalgamation of all these things, the Twitter mob that is trying to shut anyone down who questions the paradigm. And my friend said, that's because people today, and she was specifically talking about young men, but people today haven't been tested. And I thought that was kind of an interesting point. You know, my grandparents were tested. I remember how much they saved everything because they lived through the Great Depression. And my generation, I'm Gen X and younger than me, really hasn't been tested in any way. And so a lot of the, I think, gut reaction is to panic and want everyone else to panic with you instead of saying, I'm going to face this head on and we're going to figure out how to deal with it.
Right, right. It's like it's the sort of the default option. Like let's cower, let's wait for somebody to save us instead of thinking, no, I'm the type of person who actually gets through this. I'm the type of person who leads us through this.
Right.
We should be fighting each other to see who could lead us the best, right? We should be fighting each other to see who is the strongest, because that's the kind of hero archetype that we look up to. I talk about hero archetypes in Chapter 2, the problem that you're noting there is that we sort of switched what we view as good. Mm. Where we used to view like these heroic figures as people who could get through anything and have a cool, calm, and collected demeanor and a good-natured joke every once in a while, let things roll off their back. Those aren't the heroes in our public life anymore. The heroes are the victims. And we've sort of elevated victimhood to this enormous status to a point where people are actually seeking it out.
Yeah.
As a good thing. And you know, you see this in like the Jussie Smollett race crime hoax.
Right.
And, see it with Elizabeth Warren claiming things that aren't true. And I also talk about in chapter 8, do something hard. And it's as simple as it sounds. You do things that are hard because you do recognize that you have a very easy life. Mm. If you live in 2020, you would have an easy life. We have the best time in modern history. And it's the best time to be going through a pandemic, to be honest with you, given all the technology we have, given the comforts that we have. Yes, things are hard, but guess what? Your ancestors had it much, much worse.
Yeah.
It's important to have that perspective. And it's important to challenge yourself so that when hard times do come, like now, you are more prepared for it.
I think that the fact that we have it so easy is the part of the problem, though. You know, the so many people right now are just watching Netflix, and I can't imagine. Can you imagine if we'd have had Netflix in the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, right? I mean, and it's like we just feel like when we're done, my job will be there, or when we're done, it will go back to normal. And it's like, no, the longer we stay locked down, the less normal it's going to be when we go back. And frankly, more people are going to die from the consequences of this than the virus ever dreamed of.
Yeah, and that's objectively true. You know, people have been talking about suicides and mental health issues, and those are true. But there's also quite a bit of medical procedures being put off that just cannot be put off any longer. And our policymakers have to use a bit more common sense when they're looking at what to restrict and what not to restrict. And common sense has been, unfortunately, put aside. And I have a real problem with that, and I'm going to continue to be outspoken about it.
If I had a son, if I had a son right now and we were doing the whole homeschooling thing, I would make him read this book, Fortitude, American Resilience, The Air of Outrage. I love the last thing you said there, do something hard. I'm pretty sure my dad used to create things that were hard and pretend like they needed to be done to make me do them. And there wasn't really a purpose other than to make me do something hard. We're missing that in raising young men today, I think, in a big way.
Yeah, absolutely. What your dad was doing is ancient wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing new that I write about in this book. I'm just describing it in more modern ways and, frankly, rediscovering it for people because, you know, all of the lessons I teach there, yeah, you could probably trace them back to some old thing that your mom or dad taught you. You know, count to 10 before you react. Really simple. That's basically what chapter 4 is, be still.
Right.
And, you know, just basic things like that. Do hard stuff because there's moral, spiritual, and physical benefit to doing so.
Yeah.
There just is. There has been for a very long time. Suffering is talked about in the Bible as a way to build character and hope.
Right.
And, you know, we glory in our suffering, it says the Bible. And so this is old stuff, but we have to rediscover it.
All right, I know you have to run. One last thing. You know, you mentioned risk. Are we going to have that hard conversation with ourselves as Americans that when we open up, whenever that is, more people are going to die? The question is, are we going to have our hospitals ready to deal with it? Because we have to understand we live in a world of risk. People die from the flu. They die from other things. People will probably continue to die from the coronavirus. It's a hard conversation we have to have with ourselves, but say, look, we're going to have to take that risk, and the risk is going to be worth it because the downside of not taking that risk is not going to be a pretty picture.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're already having that conversation. I'm certainly very outspoken about this, but like, it's going to be hard, and we're going to be called murderers.
Yeah.
But the truth is that yes, we have to live with risk. Nobody ever said that flattening the curve meant the virus goes away.
Right.
Okay. And people need to be told the truth about this. The area under the curve doesn't change. The whole point of flattening the curve is to save our healthcare system so that we can deal with outbreaks as they come. And we need to stop finding excuses to stay locked down. Like the more recent one was, well, we just don't have enough tests yet. Well, what is the right number of tests? I mean,
right.
I agree we don't have enough. I'm not saying open things up in Houston tomorrow, but I am pushing back very hard against this notion that we should extend beyond our current deadline at the end of the month.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and unless you're going to explain to me in a very, very methodical fashion what exactly, what data points we need to hit in order to do this action,
right,
then, you know, I'm going to question your ability to analyze this. Right. And frankly, a lot of our local leaders are not engaging in sophisticated critical thinking.
Yeah. Well, listen, I appreciate your time this morning. Your book is amazing. I want people to go out and get it right away. Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. By the way, my sister lives about 90 miles north of you in Hemp Hill, Texas. You know where that is?
I know it's 90 miles north of me.
He knows where that is now. Congressman Kent Crenshaw, thank you for your service. Thanks for your book, and thanks for your time getting out there and spreading the good word. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
All right, have a good one. Congressman Dan Crenshaw, 10-year Navy SEAL. Pretty amazing guy, and great stuff in his book. Let me just expound on what he said. He's on a book tour, and it's kind of tight time, so I would love to have gone into a longer form conversation about what opening back up would look like. But I have heard some of what he has to say, and it lines up with what I'm thinking. And, you know, I want to go back to the comment that I got from what I'm going to assume is a nurse, and they were saying, I made a joke about Governor Beshear on Twitter. And I was like, you know, I feel like 75% of Kentucky has joined a cult, and it's the cult of Andy Dad jeans. And I'm being somewhat facetious and funny. And this person, I guess, took very strong offense to that, being a nurse, and was like, well, if you would just put on a mask and come in here and see what we deal with every day on the front lines, you would see that this is no dad jeans joke. And I wanted to respond to that on Twitter so bad, because I wanted to be like, I always love the you can't have an opinion on something because you're not a teacher, or you can't have an opinion on schools. You can't have an opinion on a health crisis because you're not a doctor or a nurse. You know, I would always get, when I would talk about schools and reform and choice and stuff, the thing, you can't have an opinion on schools because you're not a teacher. And I'm like, the hell, I can't have an opinion. I pay taxes that fund the schools, right? Okay, in this case, you know, I wanted to respond, and I didn't, but I guess in a way I kind of am now. But I just wanted to say, look, I respect the heck out of what you do if you're a nurse or a doctor. First of all, many nurses and doctors across the country are out of work right now because the expected wave of patients didn't show up, especially in those rural areas. However, on some areas, geographically, there are nurses and doctors on the front lines that are getting their butts kicked right now because this thing is crazy in that geographical area. But I wanted to say, look, it, besides that, and I respect the heck out of what you do, but switch, you're telling me you're virtue signaling. You're saying, I can't have an opinion because I haven't seen what you see. Well, you can't have an opinion because you haven't seen what I see. You don't know about my friend that 2 weeks before this whole thing happened, you know, metaphorically, you know, you don't know about the people that maybe 2 weeks before this happened open up a brand new business and leveraged everything they had, and now it's gone and they don't even know how they're going to pay their mortgage. Why don't you switch places with them? And Lieutenant Dan Crenshaw said something interesting during the conversation about this very thing, and it was like the bubble that we live in. And again, respect the heck out of what nurses and doctors do. Respect the heck out of what scientists do. Everyone is affected by this. So everyone gets an opinion and everyone gets input. And my original joke about Andy Beshear was essentially that here's a guy who's getting up there telling us we're all going to get through this together and nothing else of substance. And that's not what Kentucky needs. And it's like it feels like the whole state, certainly the media, has bought into this. And I'm like, where is the Kentucky I know? Of the, I'm going to fight back from this, and we're going to rise to the occasion. We're going to do this, and we're going to beat this thing. Instead, we're all burying our heads in the sand, and anyone who doesn't want to bury their heads in the sand gets accused of wanting to murder people, or not understanding, or not being able to have an opinion. And I'm like, folks, we have to tackle this in a way that another response to this is I'm not saying we open everything up tomorrow, but I am saying we open some stuff up tomorrow. Yes. Was a group of protesters at the Capitol this week. Governor Andy Beshear finally addressed the economic side of this, ironically, on the day the protesters showed up. And the mainstream media, I saw one reporter out of Lexington that wrote on Twitter, and I'm not going to name names because I don't really like to get into calling out the media. I'm a member of the media. I get it. So I won't name names. But it was a reporter on Twitter who went and said something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing, while it took a lot of cool from Andy Beshear to put up with those protesters today, I would have gone off on somebody. Now,
I wanted, again, this is something else I wanted to respond to. I didn't, but it was like, do you remember how the mainstream media treated the teachers who stormed the Capitol? And remember they broke doors and left trash and they were yelling and screaming obscenities in front of children and all this kind of stuff. And the mainstream media treated them like heroes. Then you have a group of people, and by the way, they did yell some obscenities at this protest yesterday, or the other, it was yesterday, but by the time you listen to this, it may have been a week ago, I don't know. But these protesters, and they said, the Courier Journal headline was, people yelling at the governor outside the governor's briefing, right? I mean, it was like this totally different take. So on Facebook, I posted, teacher storming the Capitol, breaking doors, leaving trash, equal heroes. Small business owners and jobless Kentuckians demanding their jobs and businesses back equal, you know, unruly mob unworthy of attention, because that's how the media treated people. The point I'm trying to say is that everyone deserves input in how we move forward. Now, let me bring it to this. And this is the thing, because before you accuse me of wanting people to die, I don't want anyone to die. I want to mitigate this virus as much as possible. However, the models are showing that we have gone far and above what we ever thought we could do in mitigating this virus. That we have now lowered the projected death total well below that of the flu. Okay? This is a great victory in pandemic fighting. But now we have to fight the economic side of this. And we have to understand there's a risk and that some people are going to die when we open back up. So here's what the plan should look like. It's very simple. As Congressman Crenshaw said, let's make sure that businesses don't have their employees standing right next to each other. Have a mitigation plan for how you're going to stay apart for a little bit. And this will help during flu season too. We will save lives next flu season and it will be awesome. Okay? Have the ability to take... I was walking into Whole Foods yesterday and there was a sign on the door that said mandatory temperature check station this way. That wasn't for me. That was for the employees. Okay. That means every business in America can do that, can have mandatory employee temperature checking as they come into work every day. Tell businesses, if you want to open up, get this technology and temperature check your employees every day. Bam. Okay, that's part of the plan. Once everybody has that in place, once we have enough PPE for the whole healthcare workers, once we have enough beds, and frankly we do now, and respirators, and frankly we do now, I think New York actually gave some of their respirators away to another area that needed it. So we have what we need. Once we have that in place and once we have testing, then we need to reopen and understand that some people are still going to get sick and a few of those are still going to die. But we have to take that risk because we're going to kill far more people from the effects of devastating economic consequences if we don't. And that is a common sense approach to reopening things. And I'm not saying you don't have concerts yet. We may not have concerts till 2022. Recognizing that. But you can still open furniture stores, as Crenshaw said. You can still open restaurants. You can still open small businesses and retail and clothing stores. You can still let people go buy their kids' shoes for school. We can still send kids to school. We can do these things in a common sense approach. All right, that's it for me. Hey, look, if you want to spread the message of the disruption zone, the best thing you can do is share this podcast with your friends and get your friends to download it. It is a free subscription at Apple Podcasts, at Google Play, and at iHeartRadio's app. You just go to iHeartRadio's app and search The Disruption Zone. You can have me delivered right to your pocket. Every time we have a new episode up, we'll go right to your pocket. Pretty awesome stuff. So make that happen. Thanks to my co-executive producer and co-host, Cameron Mills. Appreciate him, and to Dynamics Audio Productions in Lexington, Kentucky for their continued help and support of this program by helping us with the music and everything else. We appreciate them greatly. Again, you can follow us on Twitter. It's at Greatly Londo, or excuse me, on Twitter, it's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And on Instagram, it's at Greatly Londo and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.